famous psychedelic researcher, made it difficult to argue that a bright line between the scientific and the recreational use of psychedelics could be drawn and patrolled. The man had deliberately, indeed gleefully, erased all such lines. But the personality of the drug may have as much to do with the collapse of such distinctions as the personalities of people like Timothy Leary or the flaws in their research. What doomed the first wave of psychedelic research was an irrational exuberance about its potential that was nourished by the drugs themselves, that and the fact that these chemicals are what today we would call disruptive technologies. For people working with these powerful molecules, it was impossible not to conclude that, like the divinity student running down Commonwealth Avenue, you were suddenly in possession of news with the power to change not just individuals, but the world. To confine these drugs to the laboratory or to use them only for the benefit of the sick became hard to justify when they could do so much for everyone, including the researchers themselves. Leary might have made his more straight-laced colleagues cringe at his lack of caution, yet most of them shared his exuberance and had come to more or less the same conclusions about the potential of psychedelics. They were just more judicious when speaking about them in public. Who among the first generation of psychedelic researchers would dispute a word of this classic gust of Leary exuberance circa 1963? Make no mistake, the effect of consciousness-expanding drugs will be to transform our concepts of human nature, of human potentialities, of existence. The game is about to be changed, ladies and gentlemen. Man is about to make use of that fabulous electrical network he carries around in his skull. Present social establishments had better be prepared for the change. Our favorite concepts are standing in the way of a flood tide, 2 billion years building up. The verbal dam is collapsing. Head for the hills or prepare your intellectual craft to flow with the current. So perhaps Leary's real sin was to have the courage of his convictions, his and everyone else's in the psychedelic research community. It's often said that a political scandal is what happens when someone in power inadvertently speaks the truth. Leary was all too often willing to say out loud to anyone in earshot what everyone else believed but knew better than to speak or write about candidly. It was one thing to use these drugs to treat the ill and maladjusted. Society will indulge any effort to help the wayward individual conform to its norms, but it is quite another to use them to treat society itself as if it were sick and to turn the ostensibly healthy into wayward individuals. The fact is that whether by their very nature or the way that first generation of researchers happened to construct the experience, psychedelics introduced something deeply subversive to the West that the various establishments had little choice but to repulse. LSD truly was an acid, dissolving almost everything with which it came into contact, beginning with the hierarchies of the mind, the superego, ego, and unconscious, and going on from there to society's various structures of authority, and then to lines of every imaginable kind, between patient and therapist, research and recreation, sickness and health, self and other, subject and object, the spiritual and the material. If all such lines are manifestations of the Apollonian strain in Western civilization, the impulse that erects distinctions, dualities, and hierarchies and defends them, then psychedelics represented the ungovernable Dionysian force that blithely washes all those lines away. But it surely is not the case that the forces unleashed by these chemicals are necessarily ungovernable. Even the most powerful acids can be carefully handled and put to use as tools for accomplishing important things. What is the story of the first wave researchers if not a story about searching for an appropriate container for these powerful chemicals? They tested several different possibilities, the psychotomimetic, the psycholytic, the psychedelic, and still later, the entheogenic. None were perfect, but each represented a different way to regulate the power of these compounds by proposing a set of protocols for their use as well as a theoretical framework. Where Leary and the counterculture ultimately parted ways with the first generation of researchers was in deciding that no such container, whether medical, religious, or scientific, was needed, and that an unguided do-it-yourself approach to psychedelics was just fine. This is risky, as it turns out, and probably a mistake. But how would we ever have discovered this without experimenting? Before 1943, our society had never had such powerful, mind-changing drugs available to it. Other societies have had long and productive experience with psychedelics, and their examples might have saved us a lot of trouble had we only known and paid attention. The fact that we regard many of these societies as backward probably kept us from learning from them. But the biggest thing we might have learned is that these powerful medicines can be dangerous, both to the individual and the society, when they don't have a sturdy social container, a steadying set of rituals and rules, protocols, governing their use, and the crucial involvement of a guide, the figure that is usually called a shaman. Psychedelic therapy, the Hubbard method, was groping toward a westernized version of this ideal, and it remains the closest thing we have to such a protocol. For young Americans in the 1960s, for whom the psychedelic experience was new in every way, the whole idea of involving elders was probably never going to fly. But this is, I think, the great lesson of the 1960s experiment with psychedelics, the importance of finding the proper context or container for these powerful chemicals and experiences. Speaking of lines, psychedelics in the 1960s did draw at least one of them, and it has probably never before been quite so sharp or bright. The line, I mean, between generations. Saying exactly how or what psychedelics contributed to the counterculture of the 1960s is not an easy task. There were so many other forces at work. With or without psychedelics, there probably would have been a counterculture. The Vietnam War and the draft made it more than likely. But the forms the counterculture took and its distinctive styles of music, art, writing, design, and social relations would surely have been completely different were it not for these chemicals. Psychedelics also contributed to what Todd Gitlin has called the as-if mood of 1960s politics, the sense that everything was now up for grabs, that nothing given was inviolate, and that it might actually be possible to erase history, there was that acid again, and start the world over again from scratch. But to the extent that the upheaval of the 1960s was the result of an unusually sharp break between generations, psychedelics deserve much of the blame or credit for creating this unprecedented generation gap. For at what other time in history did a society's young undergo a searing rite of passage with which the previous generation was utterly unfamiliar? Normally, rites of passage help knit societies together. As the young cross over hurdles and through gates erected and maintained by their elders, coming out on the other side to take their place in the community of adults. Not so with the psychedelic journey in the 1960s, which at its conclusion dropped its young travelers onto a psychic landscape unrecognizable to their parents. That this won't ever happen again is reason to hope that the next chapter in psychedelic history won't be quite so divisive. So maybe this, then, is the enduring contribution of Leary. By turning on a generation, the generation that years later has now taken charge of our institutions, he helped create the conditions in which a revival of psychedelic research is now possible. By the end of 1966, the whole project of psychedelic science had collapsed. In April of that year, Sandoz, hoping to distance itself from the controversy engulfing the drug that Albert Hofmann would come to call his problem child, withdrew LSD-25 from circulation, turning over most of its remaining stocks to the U.S. government and leading many of the 70 research programs then underway to shut down. In May of that year, the Senate held hearings about the LSD problem. Timothy Leary and Sidney Cohen both testified, attempting valiantly to defend psychedelic research and draw lines between legitimate use and a black market that the government was now determined to crush. They found a surprisingly sympathetic ear in Senator Robert F. Kennedy, whose wife Ethel had reportedly been treated with LSD at Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver, one of Al Hubbard's outposts. Grilling the FDA regulators about their plans to cancel many of the remaining research projects, Kennedy demanded to know, quote, "Why, if these projects were worthwhile 6 months ago, why aren't they worthwhile now?" Kennedy said it would be a loss to the nation if psychedelics were banned from medicine because of illicit use. Quote, "Perhaps we have lost sight of the fact that they can be very, very helpful in our society if used properly." But Kennedy got nowhere. Leary and perhaps the drugs themselves had made drawing such distinctions impossible. In October, some 60 psychedelic researchers scattered across the United States received a letter from the FDA ordering them to stop their work. James Fadiman, the psychologist conducting experiments on creativity at the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park, remembers the day well. The letter revoking FDA approval of the project arrived at the very moment he had finished dosing four of his problem-solving creatives to begin their session. As he read the letter, sprawled on the floor in the next room, quote, four men lay, their minds literally expanding. Fadiman said to his colleagues, I think we need to agree that we got this letter tomorrow. And so it was not until the following day that the research program at the International Foundation for Advanced Study, along with virtually every other research program then underway in the United States, closed down. One psychedelic research program survived the purge, the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center at Spring Grove. Here, researchers such as Stanislav Grof, Bill Richards, Richard Jensen, and until his death in 1971, Walter Pahnke, the Good Friday researcher, continued to explore the potential of psilocybin and LSD to treat alcoholism, schizophrenia, and the existential distress of cancer patients, among other indications. It remains something of a mystery why this large psychedelic research program was allowed to continue, as it did until 1976, when dozens of others were being closed down. Some researchers who weren't so fortunate speculate that Spring Grove might have been making psychedelic therapy available to powerful people in Washington who recognized its value or hoped to learn from the research, or perhaps wanted to retain their own access to the drugs. But the former staff members at the center I spoke to doubt this was the case. They did confirm, however, that the center's director, Albert Curlin, M.D., besides having a sterling reputation among federal officials, was exceptionally well-connected in Washington and used his connections to keep the lights on and obtain LSD, some of it from the government, for a decade after they had been switched off everywhere else. Yet it turns out that the events of neither 1966 nor 1976 put an end to psychedelic research and therapy in America. Moving now underground, it went on, quietly and in secret. CODA. In February 1979, virtually all the important figures in the first wave of American psychedelic research gathered for a reunion in Los Angeles at the home of Oscar Janneker. Someone made a videotape of this event, and though the quality is poor, most of the conversation is audible. Here in Janneker's living room, we see Humphrey Osmond, Sidney Cohen, Myron Stoleroff, Willis Harmon, Timothy Leary, and sitting on the couch next to him, looking distinctly uncomfortable, Captain Al Hubbard. He's 77 or 8, and he's traveled from Casa Grande, Arizona, where he lives in a trailer park. He's wearing his paramilitary getup, though I can't tell if he's carrying a sidearm. The old men reminisce, a bit stiffly at first. Some hard feelings hang in the air, but Leary, still charming, is remarkably generous, working to put everyone at ease. Their best days are behind them. The great project to which they devoted their lives lay in ruins. But something important was accomplished, they all believe, else they wouldn't be here at this reunion. Sidney Cohen, dressed in a jacket and tie, asks the question on everyone's mind, what does it all mean? And then ventures an answer. It stirred people up. It cracked their frame of reference by the thousands, millions perhaps, and anything that does that is pretty good, I think. It's Leary of all people who asked the group, does anyone here feel that mistakes were made? Osmond, the unfailingly polite Englishman, his teeth now in full revolt, declines to use the word mistake. What I would say is, you could have seen other ways of doing it. Someone I don't recognize cracks. There was a mistake made. Nobody gave it to Nixon. It's Myron Stoleroff who finally confronts the elephant in the room, turning to Leary to say, we were a little disturbed at some of the things you were doing that were making it more difficult to carry on legitimate research. Leary reminds him that, as he told them then, he had a different role to play. Let us be the far-out explorers. The farther out we go, the more ground it gives the people at Spring Grove to denounce us, and so appear responsible. And I just wish, I hope we all understand that we've all been playing parts that have been assigned to us, and there's no good guy, bad guy, or credit or blame, whatever. Well, I think we need people like Tim and Al, Sidney Cohen offers, genially accepting Leary's framing. They're absolutely necessary to get out, way out, too far out, in fact, in order to move the ship, turn things around. Then, turning to Osmond, and we need people like you to be reflective about it and to study it. And little by little, a slight movement is made in the totality. So, you know, I can't think of how it could have worked out otherwise. Al Hubbard listens intently to all this, but has little to add. He fiddles with a hardback book in his lap. At one point, he pipes up to suggest that the work should go on, drug laws be damned. We should just keep on doing it, he says. Wake people up. Let them see for themselves what they are. I think old Carter could stand a good dose. Carter's defense secretary, Harold Brown, and CIA director Stansfield Turner, too. But Hubbard's not at all sure he wants to be on this couch with Timothy Leary, and is less willing than the others to let bygones be bygones or Leary off the hook, no matter how solicitous he is of the captain. Oh, Al, I owe everything to you, Leary offers at one point, beaming his most excellent smile at Hubbard. The Galactic Center sent you down just at the right moment. Hubbard doesn't crack a smile. And then, a few minutes later, you sure as heck contributed your part. Chapter 4. Travelogue. Journeying Underground. My plan had been to volunteer for one of the Hopkins or NYU experimental trials. If I was going to have my own guided psychedelic journey, a harrowing prospect under any circumstances, I very much liked the idea of traveling in the company of trained professionals close by a hospital emergency room. But the above-ground researchers were no longer working with healthy normals. This meant that if I hoped to have the journey I had heard so much about, it would have to take place underground. Could I find a guide willing to work with a writer who planned to publish an account of his journey, and would that person be someone I felt sufficiently comfortable with and confident in to entrust with my mind? The whole endeavor was fraught with uncertainty and entailed risks of several kinds, legal, ethical, psychological, and even literary, for how do you put into words an experience said to be ineffable? Curiosity is an accurate but tepid word for what drove me. By now, I had interviewed at length more than a dozen people who had gone on guided psychedelic journeys, and it was impossible to listen to their stories without wondering what the journey would be like for oneself. For many of them, these were among the two or three most profound experiences of their lives, in several cases changing them in positive and lasting ways. To become more open, especially at this age, when the grooves of mental habit have been etched so deep as to seem inescapable, was an appealing prospect. And then there was the possibility, however remote, of having some kind of spiritual epiphany. Many of the people I'd interviewed had started out stone-cold materialists and atheists, no more spiritually developed than I, and yet several had had mystical experiences that left them with the unshakable conviction that there was something more to this world than we know, a beyond of some kind that transcended the material universe I presumed to constitute the whole shebang. I thought often about one of the cancer patients I interviewed, an avowed atheist who had nevertheless found herself bathed in God's love. Yet not everything I'd heard from these people made me eager to follow them onto the couch. Many had been born by psilocybin deep into their pasts, a few of them traveling all the way back to scenes of unremembered childhood trauma. These journeys had been wrenching, shaking the travelers to their core, but they had been cathartic too. Clearly these medicines, as guides both above and below ground invariably call the drugs they administer, powerfully stir the psychic pot, surfacing all sorts of repressed material, some of it terrifying and ugly. Did I really want to go there? No, to be perfectly honest. You should know I have never been one for deep or sustained introspection. My usual orientation is more forward than back or down, and I generally prefer to leave my psychic depths undisturbed, assuming they exist. There's quite enough to deal with up here on the surface. Maybe that's why I became a journalist rather than a novelist or poet. All that stuff down there in the psychic basement has been stowed there for a reason. And unless you're looking for something specific to help solve a problem, why would anyone willingly go down those steps and switch on that light? People generally think of me as a fairly even-keeled and psychologically sturdy person, and I've played that role for so long now, in my family as a child, in my family as an adult, with my friends and with my colleagues, that it's probably an accurate enough characterization. But every so often, perhaps in the wee hour throes of insomnia or under the influence of cannabis, I have found myself tossed in a psychic storm of existential dread so dark and violent that the keel comes off the boat, capsizing this trusty identity. At such times, I begin seriously to entertain the possibility that somewhere deep beneath the equable presence I present, there exists a shadow me made up of forces roiling, anarchic, and potentially mad. Just how thin is the skin of my sanity? There are times when I wonder, perhaps we all do, but did I really want to find out? R.D. Lang once said, there are three things human beings are afraid of: death, other people, and their own minds. Put me down as 2 for 3. But there are moments when curiosity gets the better of fear. I guess for me, such a moment had arrived. By psychedelic underground, I don't mean the shadowy world of people making, selling, and using psychedelic drugs illegally. I have in mind a specific subset of that world, populated by perhaps 100 guides or therapists working with a variety of psychedelic substances in a carefully prescribed manner with the intention of healing the ill or bettering the well by helping them fulfill their spiritual, creative, or emotional potential. Many of these guides are credentialed therapists, so by doing this work, they are risking not only their freedom, but also their professional licenses. I met one who is a physician and heard about another. Some are religious professionals, rabbis and ministers of various denominations. A few call themselves shamans. One described himself as a druid. The rest are therapists, trained in dizzying combinations of alternative schools. I met Jungians and Reichians, Gestalt therapists and transpersonal psychologists, energy healers, practitioners of aura work, breath work, and body work, EST, past life and family constellation therapists, vision questers, astrologers, and meditation teachers of every stripe, a shaggy reunion of that whole 1970s class of alternative modalities that usually get lumped together under the rubric of the human potential movement, and that has as its world headquarters Esalen. The New Age terminology can be a little off-putting. There were times when I felt I was listening to people whose language and vocabulary had stopped evolving sometime in the early 1970s, at the very moment when psychedelic therapy was forced underground, freezing a subculture in time. I tracked down several of these people in the Bay Area, which probably has the largest concentration of underground guides in the country, without much difficulty. Asking around, I soon discovered that a friend had a friend who worked with a guide down in Santa Cruz doing an annual psilocybin journey on the occasion of his birthday. I also soon discovered that the membrane between the above ground and the below ground psychedelic worlds is permeable in certain places. A couple of the people I befriended while reporting on the university psilocybin trials were willing to introduce me to colleagues who worked underground. One introduction led to another as people came to trust my intentions. By now, I've interviewed 15 underground guides and have worked with 5. Considering the risks involved, I found most of these people unexpectedly open, generous, and trusting. Although the authorities have so far shown no interest in going after people practicing psychedelic-assisted therapy, the work remains illegal and so is dangerous to share with a journalist without taking precautions. All the guides asked me not to disclose their names or locations and to take whatever other measures I could to protect them. With that in mind, I have changed not only their names and locations, but also certain other identifying details in each of their stories. But all the people you are about to meet are real individuals, not composites or fictions. Virtually all of the underground guides I met are descended in one way or another from the generation of psychedelic therapists working on the West Coast and around Cambridge during the 1950s and 1960s when this work was still legal. Indeed, just about everyone I interviewed could trace a professional lineage reaching back to Timothy Leary, often through one of his graduate students, Stanislav Grof, Al Hubbard, or a Bay Area psychologist named Leo Zeff. Zeff, who died in 1988, was one of the earliest underground therapists, and certainly the most well-known. He claims to have processed, Al Hubbard's term, 3,000 patients and trained 150 guides during his career, including several of the ones I met on the West Coast. Zeff also left a posthumous and anonymous account of his work in the form of a 1997 book called The Secret Chief, a series of interviews with a therapist called Jacob, conducted by his close friend Myron Stolaroff. In 2004, Zeff's family gave Stolaroff permission to disclose his identity and republish the book as The Secret Chief Revealed. On the evidence of his interviews, Zeff is in many ways typical of the underground therapists I met, in both his approach and his manner. He comes across rather as folksy or Hamish, to use a Yiddish word Zeff would have appreciated, rather than as a renegade, guru, or hippie. In a photograph included in the 2004 edition, a smiling Zeff, wearing a big pair of aviator glasses and a sweater vest over his shirt sleeves, looks more like a favorite uncle than either an outlaw or mystic. Yet he was both. Zeff was a 49-year-old Jungian therapist practicing in Oakland in 1961 when he had his first trip on 100 micrograms of LSD. It might have been Stolaroff himself who first tripped him, to borrow one of Zeff's locutions. The guide had asked him to bring along an object of personal significance, so Zeff brought his Torah. After the effects of the LSD had come on, his guide, quote, laid the Torah across my chest, and I immediately went into the lap of God. He and I were one. Zeff soon began incorporating a range of different psychedelics in his practice and found that the medicines helped his patients break through their defenses, bringing buried layers of unconscious material to the surface, and achieve spiritual insights, often in a single session. The results were so fantastic, he told Stolaroff, that when the federal government put psychedelics on Schedule 1 in 1970, prohibiting their use for any purpose, Zeff made the momentous decision to continue his work underground. This was not easy. Many times I'd be in much agony falling asleep and wake up in the morning and have it hit me, he told Stolaroff. Jacob, his pseudonym, for Christ's sake, what are you exposing yourself to all this shit for? You don't need it. Then I'd look and I'd say, look at the people, look what's happening to them. I'd say, is it worth it? Inevitably, I'd come back with, yeah, it's worth it. Whatever you have to go through, it's worth it to produce these results. During his long career, Zeff helped codify many of the protocols of underground therapy, setting forth the agreements guides typically make with their clients regarding confidentiality, strict, sexual contact, forbidden, obedience to the therapist's instructions during the session, absolute, and so on, and developing many of the ceremonial touches, such as having participants take the medicine from a cup, quote, a very important symbol of the transformation experience. Zeff also described the departures from conventional therapeutic practice common among psychedelic guides. He believed it was imperative that guides have personal experience of any medicine they administer. Above-ground guides either don't seek such experience or don't admit to it. He came to believe that guides should not try to direct or manipulate the psychedelic journey, allowing it instead to find its own course and destination. Just leave them alone, he tells Stolaroff. Guides should also be willing to drop the analyst's mask of detachment, offering their personalities and emotions, as well as a comforting touch or hug to the client undergoing a particularly challenging trip. In his introduction to The Secret Chief Revealed, Myron Stolaroff sketched the influence of underground guides like Leo Zeff on the field as a whole, suggesting that the legitimate psychedelic research that resumed in the late 90s when he was writing had, quote, evolved as a result of anecdotal evidence from underground therapists like Zeff, as well as from the first wave of psychedelic research done in the 1950s and 1960s. Psychedelic researchers working in universities today are understandably reluctant to acknowledge it, but there is a certain amount of traffic between the two worlds and a small number of figures who move, somewhat gingerly, back and forth between them. For example, some prominent underground therapists have been recruited to help train a new cohort of psychedelic guides to work in university trials of psychedelic drugs. When the Hopkins team wanted to study the role of music in the guided psilocybin session, it reached out to several underground guides, surveying their musical practices. No one had any idea how many underground guides were working in America or exactly what that work consisted of until 2010. That was the year James Fadiman, the Stanford-trained psychologist who took part in psychedelic research at the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park in the early 1960s, attended a conference on psychedelic science in the Bay Area. The conference was organized by MAPS, with sponsorship from Hefter, the Beckley Foundation, and Bob Jesse's Council on Spiritual Practices, the three other nonprofits that funded most of the psychedelic research underway at the time. In a Holiday Inn in San Jose, the conference brought together more than 1,000 people, including several dozen scientists who presented their research complete with PowerPoint slides, a number of guides drawn from both the university trials and the underground, and a great many more psychonauts, people of all ages who make regular use of psychedelics in their lives, whether for spiritual, therapeutic, or recreational purposes. As Bob Jesse is always quick to remind me whenever I use that word, recreational doesn't necessarily mean frivolous, careless, or lacking in intention. Point taken. James Fadiman came to the MAPS conference on the science track, he says, to give a talk about the value of the guided and theogenic journey. He wondered if there were many underground guides in the audience, so at the end of his talk, he announced that there would be a meeting of guides at 8 the following morning. I dragged myself out of bed at 7:30, expecting to see maybe 5 people, but 100 showed up. It was staggering. It would probably be too strong to describe the far-flung and disparate group as a community, much less an organization, yet my interviews with more than a dozen of them suggest they are professionals who share an outlook, a set of practices, and even a code of conduct. Soon after the meeting in San Jose, a wiki appeared on the internet, a collaborative website where individuals can share documents and together create new content. Fadiman included the URL in his 2011 book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. Here, I found 2 items of particular interest, as well as several sub-wikis, documents under development, that hadn't had a new entry for several years. It could be that public disclosure of the site in Fadiman's book had led the creators to abandon it or move elsewhere online. The first item was a draft charter, quote, to support a category of profound, prized experiences becoming more available to more people. These experiences are described as, quote, unitive consciousness and non-dual consciousness, among other terms, and several non-pharmacological modalities for achieving these states are mentioned, including meditation, breathwork, and fasting. Quote, a principal tool of the guides is the judicious use of a class of psychoactive substances known to be potent spiritual catalysts. The website offers would-be guides links to printable forms for legal releases, ethical agreements, and medical questionnaires. We don't have very good insurance, one guide told me with a sardonic smile, so we're very careful. There's also a link to a thoughtful code of ethics for spiritual guides, which acknowledges the psychological and physical risks of journeying and emphasizes the guide's ultimate responsibility for the well-being of the client. Recognizing that during, quote, primary religious practices, participants may be especially open to suggestion, manipulation, and exploitation, the code states that it is incumbent upon the guide to disclose all risks, obtain consent, guarantee confidentiality, protect the safety and health of participants at all times, quote, safeguard against ambition and self-promotion, and accommodate clients, quote, without regard to their ability to pay. Perhaps the most useful document on the website is the Guidelines for Voyagers and Guides. The guidelines represent a compendium of half a century's accumulated knowledge and wisdom about how best to approach the psychedelic journey, whether as a participant or as a guide. It covers the basics of set and setting, mental and physical preparation for the session, potential drug interactions, the value of formulating an intention, what to expect during the experience, both good and bad, the stages of the journey, what can go wrong and how to deal with frightening material, the supreme importance of post-session integration, and so on. For me, standing on the threshold of such an experience, it was reassuring to learn that the underground community of psychedelic guides, which I had assumed consisted of a bunch of individuals all doing pretty much their own thing, operated like professionals, working from a body of accumulated knowledge and experience and in a set of traditions that had been handed down from psychedelic pioneers such as Al Hubbard, Timothy Leary, Myron Stolaroff, Stan Grof, and Leo Zeff. They had rules and codes and agreements, and many elements of the work had been more or less institutionalized. Stumbling upon the website also made me appreciate just how far the culture of psychedelics has evolved since the 1950s and 1960s. Implicit in these documents, it seemed to me, was the recognition that these powerful anarchic medicines can and have been misused, and that if they are to do more good than harm, they require a cultural vessel of some kind. Protocols, rules, and rituals that together form a kind of Apollonian counterweight to contain and channel their sheer Dionysian force. Modern medicine, with its controlled trials and white-coated clinicians and DSM diagnoses, offers one such container. The underground guides offer another. Yet, the first couple of guides I interviewed did not fill me with confidence. Maybe it was because I was so new to the territory and nervous about the contemplated journey, but I kept hearing things in their spiels that set off alarm bells and made me want to run in the opposite direction. Andre, the first guide I interviewed, was a gruff Romanian-born psychologist in his late 60s with decades of experience. He had worked with a friend of a friend of a friend. We met at his office in a modest neighborhood of small bungalows and neat lawns in a city in the Pacific Northwest. A hand-lettered sign on the door instructed visitors to remove their shoes and come upstairs to the dimly lit waiting room. A Killam rug had been pinned to the wall. Instead of a table piled with old copies of People or Consumer Reports, I found a small shrine populated with spiritual artifacts from a bewildering variety of traditions. A Buddha, a crystal, a crow's wing, a brass bowl for burning incense, a branch of sage. At the back of the shrine stood two framed photographs, one of a Hindu guru I didn't recognize, and the other of a Mexican curandera I did, Maria Sabina. This was not the last time I would encounter such a confusing tableau. In fact, every guide I met maintained some such shrine in the room where he or she worked, and clients were often asked to contribute an item of personal significance before embarking on their journeys. What I was tempted to dismiss as a smorgasbord of equal opportunity New Age tchotchkes, I would eventually come to regard more sympathetically as the material expression of the syncretism prevalent in the psychedelic community. Members of this community tend to be more spiritual than religious in any formal sense, focused on the common core of mysticism or cosmic consciousness that they believe lies behind all the different religious traditions. So what appeared to me as a bunch of conflicting symbols of divinity are in fact different means of expressing or interpreting the same underlying spiritual reality, the perennial philosophy that Aldous Huxley held to undergird all religions and to which psychedelics supposedly can offer direct access. After a few minutes, Andre bounded into the room, and when I stood to offer my hand, he surprised me with a bear hug. A big man with a full head of hastily combed gray hair, Andre was wearing a blue-checked button-down over a yellow T-shirt that struggled to encompass the globe of his belly. Speaking with a thick accent, he managed to seem both amiable and disconcertingly blunt. Andre had had his first experience with LSD at 21, soon after he came out of the army. A friend had sent it from America, and the experience transformed him. "It made me realize we live a very limited version of what life is," he said. That realization propelled him on a journey through Eastern religion and Western psychology that eventually culminated in a doctorate in psychology. When military service threatened to interrupt his psycho-spiritual journey, he decided I have to make my own choices and deserted. Andre eventually left Bucharest for San Francisco, bound for what he had heard was the first New Age graduate school, the California Institute of Integral Studies. Founded in 1968, the Institute specializes in transpersonal psychology, a school of therapy with a strong spiritual orientation rooted in the work of Carl Jung and Abraham Maslow, as well as the wisdom traditions of the East and the West, including Native American healing and South American shamanism. Stanislav Grof, a pioneer of both transpersonal and psychedelic therapy, has been on the faculty for many years. In 2016, the Institute began offering the nation's first certificate program in psychedelic therapy. As part of his degree program, Andre had to undergo psychotherapy and found his way to a Native American doing medicine work in the Four Corners as well as the Bay Area. Whoopee, he recalled thinking. Because of my LSD experience, I knew it was viable. Medicine work became his vocation. I help people find out who they are so they can live their lives fully. I used to work with whoever came to me, but some were too fucked up. If you're on the edge of psychosis, this work can push you over. You need a strong ego in order to let go of it and then be able to spring back to your boundaries. He mentioned he'd once been sued by a troubled client who blamed him for a subsequent breakdown. So I decided I don't work with crazies anymore. And as soon as I made this statement to the universe, they stopped coming. These days, he works with a lot of young people in the tech world. I'm the dangerous virus of Silicon Valley. They come to me wondering, what am I doing here, chasing the golden carrot in the golden cage? Many of them go on to do something more meaningful with their lives. The experience opens them up to the spiritual reality. It's hard to say exactly what put me off working with Andre, but oddly enough, it was less the new agey spiritualism than his nonchalance about a process I still found exotic and scary. I don't play the psychotherapy game, he told me, as blasé as a guy behind a deli counter wrapping and slicing a sandwich. None of that blank screen. In mainstream psychology, you don't hug. I hug. I touch them. I give advice. I have people come stay with us in the forest. He works with clients not here in the office, but in a rural location deep in the woods of the Olympic Peninsula. Those are all big no-nos. He shrugged as if to say, so what? I shared some of my fears. He'd heard it all before. You may not get what you want, he told me, but you'll get what you need. I gulped mentally. The main thing is to surrender to the experience, even when it gets difficult. Surrender to your fear. The biggest fears that come up are the fear of death and the fear of madness. But the only thing to do is surrender. So surrender. Andre had named my two biggest fears, but his prescription seemed easier said than done. I was hoping for a guide who exuded perhaps a little more tenderness and patience, I realized. Yet I wasn't sure I should let Andre's gruff manner put me off. He was smart, he had loads of experience, and he was willing to work with me. Then he told a story that decided the matter. It was about working with a man my age who became convinced during his psilocybin journey he was having a heart attack. I'm dying, he said. Call 911. I feel it, my heart. I told him to surrender to the dying. That St. Francis said that in dying you gain eternal life. When you realize death is just another experience, there's nothing more to worry about. Okay, but what if it had been a real heart attack, out there in the woods in the middle of the Olympic Peninsula? Andre mentioned that an aspiring guide he was training had once asked me, what do you do if someone dies? I don't know what I expected him to say, but Andre's reply, delivered with one of his most matter-of-fact shrugs, was not it. You bury him with all the other dead people. I told Andre I would be in touch. The psychedelic underground was populated with a great many such vivid characters, I soon discovered, but not necessarily the kinds of characters to whom I felt I could entrust my mind, or for that matter, any part of me. Immediately after my session with Andre, I had a meeting with a second prospective guide, a brilliant psychologist in his 80s who'd been a student of Timothy Leary's at Harvard. His knowledge of psychedelics was deep. His credentials impressive. He had been highly recommended by people I respected. Yet when over lunch at a Tibetan restaurant near his office, he removed his bolo tie and suspended it over the menu, I began to lose confidence that this was my man. He explained that he relied on the energies released by the pendulum swing of the silver clasp to choose the entree most likely to agree with his temperamental digestion. I forget what his tie ordered for lunch, but even before he began dilating on the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job, I knew my search for a guide was not over quite yet. One notable difference about doing psychedelics at 60, as opposed to when you're 18 or 20, is that at 60, you're more likely to have a cardiologist you might want to consult in advance of your trip. That was me. A year before I had decided to embark on this adventure, my heart, the reliable operations of which I had taken completely for granted to that point, had suddenly made its presence felt and, for the first time in my life, demanded my attention. While sitting at my computer one afternoon, I was suddenly made aware of a pronounced and crazily syncopated new rhythm in my chest. Atrial fibrillation was the name the doctor gave the abnormal squiggles that appeared on my EKG. The danger of AFib is not a heart attack, he said, to my short-lived relief, but a heightened risk of stroke. My cardiologist, the unfortunate phrase had suddenly joined my vocabulary, probably for the duration, put me on a couple of meds to calm the heart rhythms and lower the blood pressure, plus a daily baby aspirin to thin my blood, and then he told me not to worry about it. I followed all of his advice except the last bit. Now I couldn't help but think about my heart constantly. All of its operations that had previously taken place completely outside my conscious awareness suddenly became salient, something I could hear and feel whenever I thought to check in, which was now incessantly. Months later, the AFib had not recurred, but my surveillance of my poor heart had gotten out of control. I checked my blood pressure daily and listened for signs of ventricular eccentricity every time I got into bed. It took months of not having a stroke before I could once again trust my heart to go about its business without my supervision. Gradually, thankfully, it retreated once again to the background of my attention. I tell you all this by way of explaining why I felt I should talk to my cardiologist before embarking on a psychedelic journey. My cardiologist was my age, so not likely to be shocked by the words psilocybin or LSD or MDMA. I told him what I had in mind and asked if any of the drugs in question were contraindicated, given my coronary issues, or if there were any risks of an interaction with the meds he had prescribed. He was not overly concerned about the psychedelics. Most of them concentrate their effects in the mind with remarkably little impact on the cardiovascular system, but one of the drugs I mentioned he advised I avoid. This was MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, which has been on Schedule 1 since the mid-1980s when it emerged as a popular rave drug. The drug, 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, is not a classical psychedelic. It works on different brain receptors and doesn't have strong visual effects, yet several of the guides I was interviewing had told me it was part of their regimen. Sometimes called an empathogen, MDMA lowers psychological defenses and helps to swiftly build a bond between patient and therapist. Leo Zeff was one of the first therapists to use MDMA in the 1970s after the compound was popularized by his friend, the legendary Bay Area chemist Sasha Shulgin, and his wife, the therapist Ann Shulgin. Guides told me MDMA was a good way to break the ice and establish trust before the psychedelic journey. One said, it condenses years of psychotherapy into an afternoon. But as the scientific name indicates, MDMA is an amphetamine, and so chemically it implicates the heart in a way psychedelics don't. I was disappointed my cardiologist had taken MDMA off the table, but pleased he had more or less given me a green light on the rest of my travel plans. Trip 1. LSD. At least on paper, nothing about the first guide I chose to work with sounds auspicious. The man lived and worked so far off the grid in the mountains of the American West that he had no phone service, generated his own electricity, pumped his own water, grew his own food, and had only the spottiest satellite internet. I could just forget about the whole idea of being anywhere in range of a hospital emergency room. Then there was the fact that while I was a Jew from a family that had once been reluctant to buy a German car, this fellow was the son of a Nazi, a German in his mid-60s whose father had served in the SS during World War II. After I had heard so much about the importance of both set and setting, none of these details augured especially well. Yet I liked Fritz from the moment he came out to greet me, offering me a broad grin and a warm hug, I was getting used to these, when I pulled my rental into his remote camp. This consisted of a tidy village of structures, a handmade house and a couple of smaller cabins, an octagonal yurt, and two gaily painted outhouses set out in a clearing on the crest of a heavily wooded mountain. Following the hand-drawn map Fritz had sent me, the area was terra incognita for GPS, I drove for miles on a dusty dirt road that passed through the blasted landscape of an abandoned mine before rising into a dark forest of cypress and ponderosa pine, with a dense understory of manzanitas, their smooth bark the color of fresh blood. I had come to the middle of nowhere. Fritz was a tangle of contradiction and yet manifestly a warm and seemingly happy man. At 65, he resembled a European movie actor gone slightly to seed, with thick gray hair parted in the middle and a blocky muscular frame just beginning to yield. Fritz grew up in Bavaria, the son of a raging alcoholic who had served in the SS as a bodyguard for the cultural attaché responsible for producing operas and other entertainments for the troops, the Nazis' USO. Later, his father fought on the Russian front and survived Stalingrad, but came home from the war shell-shocked. Fritz grew up in the dense shade of his misery, sharing the shame and anger of so many in his post-war generation. "When the military came for me to serve his period of conscription," he said, as we sat at his kitchen table sipping tea on a sunny spring afternoon, "I told them to fuck themselves, and they threw me into prison." Forced eventually to serve in the army, Fritz was court-martialed twice, once for setting his uniform on fire. He spent time in solitary confinement reading Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and plotting revolution with the Maoist in the next cell, with whom he communicated through the prison plumbing. My proudest moment was the time I gave all the guards orange sunshine that I had gotten from a friend in California. At university, he studied psychology and took a lot of LSD, which he obtained from the American troops stationed in Germany. Compared to LSD, Freud was a joke. For him, biography was everything. He had no use for mystical experience. Fritz moved on to Jung and Wilhelm Reich, my hero. Along the way, he discovered that LSD was a powerful tool for exploring the depths of his own psyche, allowing him to re-experience and then let go of the anger and depression that hobbled him as a young man. There was more light in my life after that. Something shifted. As it had for many of the guides I had met, the mystical experience that Fritz had on psychedelics launched him on a decades-long spiritual quest that eventually blew my linear empirical mind, he said, opening him up to the possibility of past lives, telepathy, precognition, and synchronicities that defy our conceptions of space and time. He spent time on an ashram in India, where he witnessed specific scenes that had been prefigured in his psychedelic journeys. Once, making love to a woman in Germany, the two were practicing tantrism, he and she shared an out-of-body experience that allowed them to observe themselves from the ceiling. These medicines have shown me that something, quote-unquote, impossible exists. But I don't think it's magic or supernatural. It's a technology of consciousness we don't understand yet. Normally, when people start talking about the transpersonal dimensions of consciousness and morphogenetic fields, I have little, if any, patience. But there was something about Fritz that made such talk, if not persuasive, then at least provocative. He managed to express the most far-fetched ideas in a disarmingly modest, even down-to-earth way. I had the impression he had no agenda beyond feeding his own curiosity, whether with psychedelics or books on paranormal phenomena. For some people, the privilege of having had a mystical experience tends to massively inflate the ego, convincing them that they've been granted sole possession of a key to the universe. This is an excellent recipe for creating a guru. The certitude and condescension for mere mortals that usually come with that key can render these people insufferable. But that wasn't Fritz. To the contrary, his otherworldly experiences had humbled him, opening him up to possibilities and mysteries without closing him to skepticism, or to the pleasures of everyday life on this earth. There was nothing ethereal about him. I surprised myself by liking Fritz as much as I did. After 5 years spent living on a commune in Bavaria, we were all trying to undo some of the damage done to the post-war generation, he said. In 1976, he met a woman from California while hiking in the Himalayas and followed her back to Santa Cruz. There, he fell into the whole Northern California human potential scene, at various times running a meditation center for an Indian guru named Rajneesh and doing body work, including deep tissue massage and Rolfing, Gestalt and Reikian therapy, and some landscaping to pay the bills. When in 1982, soon after his father's death, he met Stan Grof at a breathwork course at Esalen, he felt he had at last found his rightful father. During the workshop, Fritz had what he described as an experience as powerful as any psychedelic. Out of the blue, I experienced myself being born, my mother giving birth to me. While this was happening, I watched the goddess Shiva on a gigantic IMAX screen, creating worlds and destroying worlds. Everyone in the group wanted what I had. He now added holotropic breathwork to his bodywork practice. Eventually, Fritz did an intensive series of multi-year trainings with Grof in Northern California and British Columbia. At one of them, he met his future wife, a clinical psychologist. Grof was ostensibly teaching holotropic breathwork, the non-pharmacological modality he had developed after psychedelics were made illegal. But Fritz said that Grof also shared with this select group his deep knowledge about the practice of psychedelic therapy, discreetly passing on his methods to a new generation. Several people in the workshop, Fritz and his future wife among them, went on to become underground guides. She works with the women who find their way up the mountain, he with the men. "You don't make a lot of money," Fritz told me. Indeed, he charged only $900 for a 3-day session, which included room and board. "It's illegal and dangerous. You can have a person go psychotic, and you really don't make a lot of money. But I'm a healer, and these medicines work." It was abundantly clear he had a calling and loved what he did, loved witnessing people undergo profound transformations before his eyes. Fritz told me what to expect if I were to work with him. It would mean returning here for 3 days, sleeping in the 8-sided yurt where we would also do the work. The first afternoon would be a warm-up or get-acquainted session using either MDMA or breathwork. I explain why in my case it would have to be breathwork. This would give him a chance to observe how I handled an altered state of consciousness before sending me on an LSD journey the morning of the second day. It would also help him determine a suitable dose. I asked him how he could be sure of the purity and quality of the medicines he uses, since they come from chemists working illicitly. "Whenever he receives a new shipment," he explained, "I first test it for purity, and then I take a heroic dose to see how it feels before I give it to anyone." Not exactly FDA approval, I thought to myself, but better than nothing. Fritz doesn't take any medicine himself while he's working, but he said he often gets a contact high from his clients. During the session, he takes notes, selects the music, and checks in every 20 minutes or so. "I'll ask you not how you are, but where you are. I'm here just for you, to hold the space, so you don't have to worry about anything or anyone else, not the wife, not the child, so you can really let go and go." This, I realized, was another reason I was eager to work with a guide. When Judith and I had had our magic mushroom day the previous summer, the simmer of worry about her welfare kept intruding on my journey, forcing me to stay close to the surface. Much as I hated the psychobabbly locution, I loved the idea of someone holding space for me. "That night, I'll ask you to make some notes before you go to sleep. On your last morning, we'll compare notes and try to integrate and make sense of your experience. Then I'll cook you a big breakfast to get you ready to face the interstate." We scheduled a time for me to come back. The first thing I learned about myself that first afternoon working with Fritz in the yurt is that I am easy to put under, susceptible to trance, a mental space completely new to me, and accessible by nothing more than a shift in the pattern of one's breathing. It was the damnedest thing. Fritz's instructions were straightforward. Breathe deeply and rapidly while exhaling as strongly as you can. "At first it will feel unnatural, and you'll have to concentrate to maintain the rhythm," he said, "but after a few minutes, your body will take over and do it automatically." I stretched out on the mattress and donned a pair of eye shades while he put on some music, something generically tribal and rhythmic, dominated by the pounding of a drum. He placed a plastic bucket at my side, explaining that occasionally people throw up. It was hard work at first to breathe in such an exaggerated and unnatural way, even with Fritz's enthusiastic coaching. But then all at once, my body took over, and I found that no thought was required to maintain the driving pace and rhythm. It was as if I had broken free from gravity and settled into an orbit. The big, deep breaths just came automatically. Now I felt an uncontrollable urge to move my legs and arms in sync with the pounding of the drums, which resonated in my rib cage like a powerful new heartbeat. I felt possessed, both my body and my mind. I can't remember many thoughts except, hey, this is working, whatever it is. I was flat on my back, dancing wildly, my arms and legs moving with a will of their own. All control of my body I had surrendered to the music. It felt a little like speaking in tongues, or what I imagined that to be, with some external force taking over.